This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Let's first turn to Dan Carton. He's the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana about the stories that he's put out there in print and online recently. And Dan, as always, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start in first here about your story about Democrats in LaPorte County. They're working hard to make some changes in the Indiana Senate, at least for Lake County or for LaPorte County's purposes. Tell us all about that.
Yeah, they're actually sort of looking to make things back the way they were. Mm-hmm. A Democrat has represented the 8th Senate District, which is mostly LaPorte County, central LaPorte County, part of South Bend, not part of St. Joseph County and Stark County.
Yeah,
they've had the seat. Democrats had the seat forever until 2016, when State Senator Mike Bohacek was able to succeed State Senator Jim Arnold, who was retiring. Senator Bohacek, the Republican. This week, the Democrats in LaPorte County nominated a guy named Gary Davis to run for the seat. He's a longtime LaPorte attorney, disability rights advocate, sort of well-known in the community, and he's looking to give Senator Bohacek a run for his money on his first reelection bid.
Yeah, I recognize the name. I've seen it in stories before, so he's very well-known up in LaPorte County about what he's done for people and involved in, I guess, really in politics, but I know he's certainly very much involved in the law in LaPorte County, and he's worked very hard for clients up there, I understand.
Yeah, and so is Senator Bohacek. Senator Bohacek has, jumped right into it. He was a former county commissioner, he understood local government, understood how that related to the state, and has been very active at the State House. He was one of the leading proponents of the bias crime law last year, and managed to get a version of that passed. It should be an interesting competitive race. There aren't a lot of very, very competitive Indiana Senate seats. The Indiana Senate has been gerrymandered in favor of Republicans for about four decades, and they've only lost, one time. They've only lost one race in this century to a Democrat. So that was outside of Indianapolis. So it's been a while since Democrats have been able to or willing to compete for seats in the Indiana Senate. So it's good to see that that voters are going to have a choice this year.
Yeah. What has Gary Davis talked about as far as the planks on his campaign are concerned?
Well, one of the things he talked about was education. He said education was going to be his top priority. It's the biggest spending item in the state budget. About half of all the money the state takes in every year goes to K-12 education. And one of the things he talked about was, rethinking how the state funds its schools and, putting in extra safety precautions for schools in light of the coronavirus pandemic. He said that's, a very important issue at this time that there hasn't been a lot of leadership on from the state.
One of the other stories that you had in print and online from the Times recently, in fact, this week, in fact, turned out to be one of our lead stories in newscast, is the conversation that you learned about from the Lake County Council meeting where the Lake County Health Department and with Lake County Health Officer Dr. Chandana Vivala had to say to the commissioners about money, or the council, rather, about money matters.
Yeah, that was kind of a surprise. She reported to the council that her office has had trouble, has lost several people during this coronavirus pandemic, and has had trouble getting them back, getting or hiring people, especially nurses, and that's making it hard to do all the extra stuff they need to do with coronavirus, plus all the usual stuff they do in terms of immunizations and tuberculosis surveillance and everything else that the health department does. A lot of the county council members were surprised to hear this because they said she hadn't been particularly forthcoming about her needs, because there is a lot of money out there from the federal government, from the state government. Even the county has some money to take care of all this coronavirus stuff. So they were urging her to be more explicit about what she needs and let them know so they can get her the resources that she needs to preserve the health of half a million people in Lake County.
Well, I know that she's been very, very busy lately just dealing with COVID-19, and I know that she's supposed to be talking, I guess, with some recommendations she's going to make as well to everybody in Lake County about trying to protect ourselves from the virus. But I guess she's not had much time to be able to pay attention to budgetary matters, and so I can see why maybe the council might be surprised that she hadn't come to them sooner.
Right, and you know, and the council's been meeting virtually, sort of online, so it's difficult to just, you know, pull somebody aside in the hallway and say, "Hey, I need some help," and you know, get that on the agenda. So everything's a little bit more complicated because of this coronavirus right now.
We're talking with Dan Carton with the Times of Northwest Indiana about his stories that are in print and online out there to check out. Another story to check out as well, is in keeping track with what the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus has been doing lately. One of your stories talks about what the caucus would like to see done concerning the racial attack that happened in southern Indiana.
Yeah. You know, this was a big issue a couple weeks ago on the 4th of July. Bloomington civil rights activist claims he was confronted by a group of white people at Monroe Lake in Bloomington. He was allegedly forced up against a tree. Somebody supposedly said, "Get a rope." There is a partial video recording of the incident,
mm-hmm.
And that's prompted a whole lot of outrage from across the country to this supposed alleged lynching. And obviously, the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, which includes six Democrats here in Northwest Indiana, responded strongly to that. They urged that the Department of Natural Resources, which manages Monroe Lake, immediately launch an investigation for potential hate crimes prosecution, and to move faster on their investigation, because this was making Indiana look bad, and obviously it's a terrible thing to happen to this person.
Mm-hmm. I know that as far as politics is concerned, that you had some stories out there lately. One of them is dealing with, I guess, the final decisions coming out of another virtual political party convention, and this one in particular for the Republicans. You talk about how the Indiana Attorney General nomination has turned out. Fill us in on that, please.
Yeah, and that was kind of a big surprise. The Indiana Republican Party did have a virtual convention. They used mail-in ballots to nominate their candidate for attorney general. In Indiana, only the governor runs in a primary for a statewide race in state government. All the other state auditor, state treasurer, secretary of state, attorney general, those positions are all nominated by each political party at their state convention. Voters don't get a say in who is the nominee on that ballot. So, on the general election ballot. So in this case, the Republican Party decided to get rid of the sitting attorney general, Curtis Hill. He's still attorney general until the end of the year, but they've nominated Todd Rokita to run on the November ballot. Todd Rokita is a Munster native, former two-term Indiana Secretary of State. He served four terms representing the sort of Lafayette area and the suburbs of Indianapolis, mm-hmm. in the U.S. House. He's a very conservative Republican. He's actually, on a policy level, he's actually very similar to Curtis Hill. He's going to push for gun rights. He's going to try and do legal maneuvers to end abortion. He wants to eliminate the Affordable Care Act. He voted to get rid of that numerous times as a member of Congress. And Indiana's part of a lawsuit right now that is seeking to eliminate that, which ironically would get rid of health care for about 500,000 people who are on the Healthy Indiana Plan, which is funded by the Affordable Care Act. So it's not much of a policy difference, but it's Rokita doesn't have the same personal problems as Curtis Hill.
Yes.
Curtis Hill earlier this year had his law license suspended by the Indiana Supreme Court. You know, an unprecedented action for the Supreme Court to suspend the Attorney General's law license. Because the Supreme Court determined that Curtis Hill had committed four counts of battery when he drunkenly groped four women at an Indianapolis bar. I guess Republican caucus or convention goers no longer wanted to be represented by a person who the Supreme Court found did those things. and opted for Todd Rokita instead. Mm-hmm.
Now, how many rounds did they have to go through to put him finally on the ballot?
Yeah, that was an interesting situation. So there were three rounds of voting. The delegates only had one ballot. They had to rank each of the four candidates in the order of their preference. And if you got the fewest votes, you were dropped, and your ballot, those ballots were assigned to the person who got the second place ranking. And then after the second person was dropped, those ballots were assigned to the person who got the third ranking. So it's interesting, Curtis Hill led on the first two rounds. So it seems like people were either really for Curtis Hill or really against Curtis Hill, but Todd Rokita was, let's say, everybody's second choice, and that put him over the top to get a majority of the delegates. Mm-hmm. And again, it was really close. It was 52-48 in the end, so not an overwhelming endorsement for Todd Rokita for the nomination, but all that matters is, you know, what happens with the November election.
That's right, and in November, so it'll turn out to be Todd Rokita and Jonathan Weinsapel that people will see on the ballot when they go into the polling place or do their mail-in ballot, depending on how things happen there. Speaking of voting hours, another story that you had here, bring us up to date briefly here about how this lawsuit may have an impact on what time people or how long people can really get to the polls and get their ballots cast in November.
Yeah, this is an interesting sort of situation. If you remember, a couple of years ago, Porter County had a lot of problems on Election Day. There were a bunch of polling places that didn't open. Absentee ballots weren't delivered to the polling places. It took them 3 days to count the ballots. And one of the reforms, on that Election Day in 2018, the Democratic Party filed a lawsuit to try and extend the polling hours at the polling places that didn't open, so the voters would have at least the 12 hours to vote that are guaranteed by state law. And the judge granted that. The General Assembly didn't like that sort of judges were extending voting hours at the request of the Democratic Party. This is a Republican-controlled General Assembly. They've, even as every other state in the country, has expanded voting hours. Indiana has maintained its 6 p.m. closing time, which is the earliest in the entire country. So, expanding voting hours isn't exactly a priority for state lawmakers at this point. They passed a law that says only the county election board is permitted to file a lawsuit to seek to extend voting hours. That creates an interesting problem because the county election board is supposed to run the election in a way that isn't screwed up in the first place. So, it makes it far more difficult for voting hours to ever be extended in Indiana, regardless of the problems at the polls.
Yeah.
Common Cause Indiana and some other sort of good government interest groups have filed a lawsuit trying to overturn that statute because they think it's important that anybody who identifies a problem at the polls has access to the courts to try and seek a remedy if that includes extending voting hours because state polling places didn't open.
Well, let's hope there's some kind of decision made on that lawsuit here before the election comes up in November. And Dan, thank you very much for spending time and covering the stories that you've had in print and online out there, and hope to have you back on again real soon.
Absolutely, anytime.
Dan Carton's the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking. The Gary, Indiana area has a response rate to the 2020 U.S. Census that is below the national rate. And the national census and the regional census based out of Chicago is very concerned about that. We'll find out more about how communities in particular and households can participate if they haven't done so yet, responding to the 2020 U.S. Census. And with us is Sam Fedick. He is based with the Chicago Regional Census Center. And Sam, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's great to be with you.
I know the concern is that there aren't enough people, in particular in Gary, Indiana, and communities around Gary, that are responding to the census itself. Response rate's only 45%, and that compares with the rest of Indiana at 66% or so, and 62% nationally. What is the Census Bureau here in Midwest, as well as the national U.S. Census, trying to do to improve response rates?
Let me just start briefly by mentioning, why it is so important that we get a high response rate in Gary and throughout the country. The census is used to determine the funding of programs like schools, local roads, healthcare, So getting a complete and accurate count in the 2020 census impacts our communities, again, in Gary and throughout the country, for the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we are so focused on trying to get that self-response rate up, both because we know that self-responses to the census are more complete, more accurate, often than other ways of getting that data, and because every household that responds to the 2020 census themselves is one fewer house that needs to be visited by a census taker going door to door when we start that in August.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the strategies that we're using to try to get that self-response rate up between now and when that door knocking starts in August, there's two main efforts going on. The first is a big push at the regional level, the local level, to work with partner organizations at the community level, really grassroots folks who work day to day in the communities that are lower responding. So that might be libraries or social services or nonprofits, the people that work with the people who we want to get encouraged to respond to the census. So one example in Gary is some local churches that are doing meal distributions, and they've been including 2020 census response materials with those meals that they're distributing. So that's one big effort that we've had going on for the past weeks and months, but we're really ramping up now in this final month here before door knocking starts. Then the second operation that we've got going to try to get the response rates up in this last month here before the door knocking begins is what we're calling mobile questionnaire assistance. So this is sending out census employees. There's about 3,000 folks nationally doing this for the Census Bureau, hired locally, sending them out to areas like grocery stores, banks, pharmacies, places they can be outside and encourage people to respond to the census and help people respond to the census. So they'll be wearing masks, they'll keep their social distance, but catching people kind of where they are, where they live as they're going about their day, people who might not have thought about the census yet, and encouraging them to respond.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier about the households that are not responding, at least on their own, and that's a very, very low within Gary and vicinity compared to the rest of Indiana and the rest of the country. And when you talk about the importance of the U.S. Census in particular, you mentioned some of the programs that are underway to help people out during the pandemic. The people probably don't realize how important participating in the census really is, that for many communities, Gary and all the other communities around Gary here in Northwest Indiana, for that matter, depend on the funds that are allocated by the state and the federal governments. And they all come in only because the census has said, we need to put this money here, isn't it?
That's exactly right. The census doesn't determine where the money goes, but the census data is used by lawmakers and by folks in the government at the federal, the state, the local level to determine where the money is needed. So it can be as specific as, you know, is there a bus stop within walking distance in your community? Good chances that decision for where to locate those transit hubs is based in part on census data.
Mm-hmm.
Another way it's used that really impacts communities is not a government use of data, but businesses use this data as well. So is there a grocery store that's nearby in your community? Businesses use that census data to determine where they can launch a new sustainable business, where there'll be enough customers to support it. So as you mentioned, it really, that's one of the challenges of our work and one of the opportunities of our work with our local partners is to make those connections and really make it real for people. There's any number of reasons why someone might not be inclined to respond to the census. But one big one we know is exactly what we're talking about, that people don't always realize just how important it is to their communities, to their everyday life.
I know that with the shift in, once we get to the period, you say, starting a little later in the year, where the census takers or enumerators, as the official term is called, have to go out there and actually start knocking on doors. I know this major concern has been brought up so far and probably continues on, not only about the coronavirus pandemic, that's another problem that has come up here, but also I know the concern that some residents are afraid to talk to the census takers. people are worried that that information may go to the wrong hands. In particular, we're talking about immigrants or possibly even undocumented immigrants, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me just start by saying that everyone who's living in the United States should be counted in the 2020 census, regardless of immigration status or citizenship status. And let me also state that Census Bureau data is only ever used for statistical purposes. It can never be used to can never be used against an individual. It can't be shared with any other federal agency, law enforcement agency. The data you submit to the Census Bureau is strictly confidential. But of course, it's one thing for me to say that, and it's another thing, as you mentioned, to get that information out to the people who need to hear it in a way that they can trust. So that's, again, where we really rely on our relationships with local leaders, local trusted voices who can help make that connection. And another piece of it, too, is speaking to the enumerators, the census takers, is hiring locally, hiring in these communities so that the person knocking on the door is not just some Census Bureau official. It's someone who knows the language, knows the culture, knows the community, might even know the person themselves personally. So these are some of the strategies we take, but you're absolutely right that that there is that concern in some communities. And for anyone who would prefer to not have census takers come to their house, whether that's due to the coronavirus or due to safety and privacy concerns, the best thing that they can do is to self-respond to the census now.
Now, where can people go to get more, first off, more information about the U.S. 2020 census, but also to be able to get their information in?
The best place, if people have access to a computer and the internet or their phones, is 2020census.gov. There's also a phone line available. With either of those options, you can self-respond there directly, as well as get a lot of great information. And both of those options are available in 12 non-English languages along with English. So that's, again, 2020census.gov, or the phone number is 844-330-2020.
Sam Fedick is a Minnesota Partnership Coordinator, but he works with the Chicago Regional Census Center. We hope that more data comes in and that Northwest Indiana and communities like Gary participate more by self-responding to the census ahead of the enumerators going out knocking on doors. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. As we continue our Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Joseph Pete, who is the business reporter and writer for The Times. And Joe, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, you had some interesting stories out lately here, a lot of them about food and a couple of them in particular about the city of Gary. Let's go into the food section first here. One involves that Target over in Calumet City that's been closed for a long time, but it has a new tenant, I understand, and a new purpose. Tell us about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that the big box store, the big box Super Target that had been located or that's located by the River Oak Center in Cal City. It's been vacant for more than 5 years now since Target had closed down that location. You've seen some other closures in that area, Best Buy, the Applebee's, a couple of the anchor stores at the mall and so on. But there is it's being repurposed. There is a new company that is coming in. It's backed by some big names in the Chicago grocery and restaurant world, including the CEO of Mariano's. But Wilder Foods, which was founded by Jay Cohen, was there. They had started with a indoor vertical farm in back of the yard, and now they've perfected artificial intelligence and robotics technology they're using to kind of keep the cost down, and they are ready to roll out their first full-scale commercial farm. They're doing so in the 135-square-foot Target by the River Oaks Mall, where they say their new technology will let them produce up to 25 billion pounds a year of food that will be sold to local supermarkets and restaurants within 100-mile radius. They have such a high yield because whether you grow vertically with artificial light, the crops go to harvest like relatively quickly within a matter of like sometimes as little as like 7 weeks or so. But they're going to be growing a variety of greens, herbs like basil, but also spinach, lettuce, some exotic ones that they say you're not able to find like locally. They're not able to be grown in Chicagoland, like tart red sorrel, horseradish tinged red mizuna, and spicy wasabi arugula. There are a couple that, you know, they can't really grow out here that they're going to start producing. And the hope is to make this into kind of like a national concept where you'll have, they want to repurpose these big box stores and turn them into, you know, large indoor farms where you'll be able to grow, obviously, like year round, and get fresh greens out to supermarkets and restaurants. This one will also have a retail component. The former food court area, they're going to turn into a retail store where people will be able to go in and buy freshly grown produce that's grown right there on site. And part of their thing is that they're, in addition to growing, like, you know, greens, they're also trying to grow the community. And in this case, you know, it's a little bit of a food desert in that area. You had the Ultra Foods down the street in Lansing closed a couple years ago. And they're kind of trying to help address that by ensuring there's access to fresh, healthy food.
It's a perfect place to have something like this because not only you have the opportunity for that that little selling area up near the front of the store, but you've got the semi-truck bays in the back that we're bringing in items for the Target store, and they can use it for shipping. So a perfect opportunity right there, too. Speaking of food, we all know that we've lost out on a lot of festivals that had to close and be canceled because of the coronavirus pandemic, and that has a great impact not only on restaurants that might be in the area that would bring in folks who attend the festivals, but the vendors and the food truck operators, and that's one of your stories recently, too. Fill us in on how bad it really is for those folks in particular.
Oh, yes. It's been very, very rough for a lot of the food vendors and food trucks since most of them. Since in Northwest Indiana, it's unlike a lot of cities where cities food trucks are generally out to set up shop, you know, wherever they want. They can then tweet out to their supporters, you know, or their followers, like, you know, we're going to be here for the next couple hours. And people go out and find them. Unfortunately, in Northwest Indiana, in many communities, they're not really allowed to operate the way they're allowed to operate in cities. They pretty much have to rely upon these. They have to rely upon these large festivals pretty much to do most of their business. And this year, of course, almost everything has been canceled, ranging from the county fairs to Pierogi Fest to Festival of the Lakes, you name it. Pretty much all the major festivals have been canceled. Some of the fair vendors I talked to, they pretty much lost, like, you know, either all of their business or more than 90% of their business. They're not really allowed to set up in cities and towns. You know, they were relying upon all these festivals and markets. They've been forced to kind of adapt to the circumstances. Some of the farmers markets are coming back, so some of them are trying to get into farmers markets, but they're doing a lot more private events, such as graduation parties, corporate events, things of that nature, and bulking up their catering. One who normally does, you know, larger festivals, for instance, like did a furniture store opening the other weekend, and usually they try to avoid such small events because if you only have like 75 people or so, it's getting close to the break-even point. If you're out there for a couple hours, you got to pay staff, you have your overhead, you know, but they're forcing to kind of scrape by to do whatever they can to survive. Many have turned more toward catering. One in particular, like Dogs and Hogs, they had an idea to do a separate barbecue catering business that they have been kind of, you know, considering for a while. And now they've decided to go ahead and just launch that because it's, you know, they need to get some money coming in the door somehow. So they started Uncle Chewy's BBQ and are hoping that's going to kind of, keep the revenue coming in.
One of the stories that you had in print and online in the Times here recently, still dealing with food. And in this case, we're talking about hot dogs and chili. The greatest combination known to mankind, I think. And we're talking about Coney King, and we don't run them any longer. When we were doing Dan Dockich's sports show years ago here on Lakeshore Public Radio, one of his little promos referred to Coney King because he's a Gary native, and he would stop by 46th and Broadway every time he would come up here to visit to get something from Coney King. You could not be in Gary, even just for a visit, without stopping at Coney King. And I understand Coney King has got a very special event coming up here later this summer, all because of a very special year. Tell us about their 100th anniversary.
Yes, it was founded by Greek immigrants, and now it's celebrating 100 years in Gary. It is the the famous, specialized in the Detroit-style Coney dog, in which you have the hot dog and it's topped with mustard, diced raw onion, and a house-made chili. They've been using the same family recipe for a century now. They also sell it by the bowl, pint, and quart, but it was acquired from the current owners by Jimi Hendrix. He's taking over the business now, and they're going to celebrate both the anniversary and the new ownership on August 8th. They're going to have a day-long block party from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. There's the mayor, Jerome Prince, is going to be there. They're going to have Merciless Mary McGee, the women's light superweight lightweight champion of the world. And then they're going to have DJs and musicians perform. It's going to be a big festival, and they're going to celebrate the history. It's a very beloved institution. It's obviously been around for a while, and it's going to be a big day.
Sounds like it's going to be a lot of folks that want to come out, and certainly not only to eat and celebrate the food, but just celebrate in general. And it's a great place to be to celebrate up there with the 100th anniversary. That makes it even more special. Also, Joe, one of the stories you've had just recently on the Times website, as well as in the newspaper proper, is about the city of Gary, and they've been having to look at some unused properties that they've owned, I guess, to help trim the budget. But one in particular that is sitting up there along 8094, that area of Gary, is up for consideration for an owner. Tell us about the South Gleason Golf Course.
Yes, the South Gleason Golf Course. Yes, the previous mayor, Karen Freeman Wilson, she had put up some city properties for potential purchase a couple years back, including the rec center downtown and the Gleason Golf Course. There was first an offer last year. The Prince administration was considering it. They're about to come into office, but there was an offer by a developer to redevelop it. It is kind of right by the Borman. It historically has not been developed because if you've ever been by the Little Cal River and, with a heavy rain, obviously that area floods quite a bit. They have invested in flood improvements, but there potentially need to be more. There will potentially need to be more sanitary or need to be more stormwater work done.
Yeah.
But it's right off the Borman, so it's potentially would be an ideal site for a lot of different development, including, maybe logistics or some kind of trucking or something of that, but there's logistically an ideal site, and there was an offer last year in August that Gary considered, but they deemed it kind of too low. They made a counter offer that was rejected, so that kind of went nowhere. But there's now a new offer on the table by a developer who wants to redevelop the property. It's a full 33% higher than the original offer. So Mayor Prince was saying that the city is pretty much seriously considering it. The part of the reason it's a historic golf course. It's been there since the Riverside Park was there since 1920.
Yeah.
I think they first built the golf course in 1928, and George Mayer, a pretty notable architect, designed the clubhouse, which was kind of innovative for its time. And it's a historic property, but it's kind of fallen into a large disuse. That's only people played only about 5,000 rounds a year there last year. Turkey Creek, they golfed 55,000 rounds. So the disuse of it kind of led the city to consider maybe it's time to repurpose this property. And if there is an offer, maybe that's something to consider because the city has been subsidizing it for years. So they are open to, no deal has been finalized yet, but potentially there could be a big overhaul of that property. It's a very prominent location. It's by just off Broadway. It's by the IUN campus. We'll see and keep tabs on what happens and update people as soon as we find out more.
I remember doing a little looking into the history books there in the city of Gary at one time, and this was mainly about focusing on the flooding that happened on IU Northwest Campus, which is adjacent to the golf course and just down the road a bit, so to speak. in the neighborhood, and mentions about the fact there was so much damage that was done in on campus back then during the flood that came in because of heavy rains and the Little Calumet River overflowing its banks, and it got the golf course too. So it mentions a lot of problems there, to be sure. So it'll be interesting to see what the, I'm sure that the Gary City Council will get to deal with once they find some final announcement about what kind of development is going to go into that site there, to be sure. Joe Pete, thank you very much for spending time with us and covering these great stories. And we'll look forward to not only to finding out your story about the big Coney King 100th anniversary celebration coming up in August, but the other great stories that will come out later, too. Thanks very much today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Joe Pete is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Ivy Tech Community College is working toward getting ready to safely reopen the schools here in Indiana and in Northwest Indiana in particular. And the president of Ivy Tech Community College, Sue Elsperman, had an opportunity to check out a national conference that happened at the White House not long ago. And Dr. Elsperman, along with the chancellor of the Lake County Ivy Tech campus, which covers Crown Point, East Chicago, and Gary, is also with us. Louis Gonzalez, Dr. Elsperman, and Mr. Gonzalez, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Wonderful to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, Dr. Elsperman, tell us first about what this conference that you attended at the White House was all about.
Well, it was the administration's national dialogue on safely reopening schools, and it was my pleasure to represent community colleges across our nation and how important we are, as well as our K-12 system and the rest of higher education, to making sure that Hoosiers and Americans have prosperous lives going forward. So it was a day of dialogue. We had the CDC there, the Secretary of Education, Secretary of Human Health Services was there, and of course the President hosted it and the Vice President as well. So it was a tremendous opportunity to have that national dialogue on the importance of, and I'll just reemphasize, safely reopening schools, which is really the challenge before all of us as we still have several months ahead of this COVID pandemic to deal with.
What did the participants in the session, including not only the president and vice president, but the secretaries that were in attendance, what do they generally have to say in how they feel about getting institutions of higher education in particular, like Ivy Tech Community College, reopened safely?
Right. The two things that really stuck with me. One was the CDC's very clear that the guidance they have been giving was never intended to shut the country down, but rather help us to move forward in a productive way. So we all know that now. It is social distancing, it is wearing masks, it is washing our hands, and it is deep cleaning, right? And how do we operate with those principles in mind, and to the extent that we can do that, that we should be able to reopen at least to some degree. And I think that is exactly the way that Ivy Tech will look at our reopening. We will absolutely continue to keep our campus densities down so that those who need to be on campus, our students that need face-to-face courses or labs or hands-on experiences. But for those who can do that learning virtually or online or in a hybrid, and for our faculty and some of those of us who are kind of back office, if we don't need to physically be there, we may not be on campus every day, because our goal is to create the safest environment for our students to succeed and do that safely. And we don't want to put our own faculty, staff, employees at risk either, or any guests that come on campus. So if you've watched Ivy Tech, we have been, we went virtual in March. We now are in our second full week of something we call completion academies, where those courses that couldn't be completed in the spring because they were labs and hands-on courses are now in very small groups and using PPE as appropriate. Those are being completed on our campuses very quietly, and we're still serving all of our students virtually. or online, because we have summer courses going online right now, and we're at full steam, almost the same enrollment we had last summer. So we're continuing to work, but we're trying to adapt just like Hoosiers would expect of us, that we know Hoosiers need IV Tech. We know there are tens of thousands of Hoosiers and more that are now unemployed that need to come back to skill up, to gain a credential, to gain a degree. And we need to be here. And I know as Louie's on the call with us today,
yes,
he's done a beautiful job on our Lake County campus of ensuring that. And if you don't mind, I want to put a little plug in for what they've been doing called Enroll and Go as another way to meet people where they are safely. I hope you'll give him a chance to talk about
yes,
that.
Yes, in fact, let's turn things over now to Chancellor Gonzalez. Tell us, sir, about a little bit about that, and in general, how you've got the Lake County campuses in Crown Point, East Chicago, and Gary ready for reopening here with the fall semester starting August 24th.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity, and thank you, Dr. Elsperman. Let me share a little bit of information about Enroll and Go. It's what we decided to do is that we decided to take our operation outside. The weather is beautiful, and we decided to bring out some tents, put them in our parking lots, have checkpoints along the way so people can actually roll up in their vehicle, stay in their vehicle. We gather the information from the student or new student, put the information in our system. Everything's mobile. We make sure that the files are complete, and then they can actually we can meet with them right there in their vehicle. We're standing outside the vehicle, and we can advise them, or they're more than welcome to come in to one classroom or two classrooms, I should say. And there's enough social distancing. We give them a mask. We give them a ticket so they can have a free lunch as well. We have a food truck here and a bottle of water. We take care of them within minutes, and they get back in their vehicle, and they're on their way. I need to share with you that there are a lot of individuals who, what they have shared with us, well, I'm glad you guys are open. It's exciting to come out and actually talk to someone. There's nothing beats that face to face, and of course we share with them what the fall term may look like. Dr. Elsperman touched on that. Mm-hmm. It might be a face to face, it might be virtual, it might be online, or it might be a hybrid of these options. But we have to explain that to them, and many times that once they get that assurance from us, then they're fine. But that really is critical, and Dr. Elsman also talked about this deep cleaning. That's what we've been doing these past few months, is doing some deep enhanced cleaning at each of the three locations. And we feel confident that once the fall semester begins on the 24th of August, we will be ready.
I know that it takes a lot of extra time here with all the extra cleaning duties to get the buildings ready for actual visiting the classrooms. It's something you obviously don't have to worry about when you're doing virtual learning, but it's something with in-person learning to be sure. What did you find? Any issues in particular because of the different ages of the buildings, the different sizes of the buildings that Ivy Tech Community College houses that you had to kind of deal with as you were doing the reviews and the actual cleaning?
Well, what we did, so I'll give you an example. At our Crown Point location, mm-hmm. We walked the building, and I was with our director of facilities and security, Bruce Curry. And Bruce said, you know, Lou, what we could do is enhance these hallways. I see that that along the walls we have some, there was a material that kind of looked like a burlap, and we decided, let's remove all of that. And replace it with some drywall, paint it, and it could be easily cleaned. And that's what we did for 3 weeks. We tore all that out. Of course, if school was in session, it would be impossible to do anything like that. But we did it on both floors. It was a big job. It got done. We had our nursing department walk through it, and they loved it. And that's the type of thing that we're looking at, every little thing that to enhance that what we call that quality that I believe is going to be essential to assure students and staff and faculty that it is a safe environment. So mm-hmm. Believe me, we're looking at everything from the rooftop down to the through the basement. We're looking at every little opportunity to enhance the environment.
Now, Dr. Elsperman, I was going to ask if there were any similar situations with the rest of the campuses in the state that the staff had to deal with. Yeah.
Well, every campus has their own team that's working, as Louis talked about, with the facilities directors and our public safety personnel and our academic personnel. All, you know, every classroom will be set up for social distancing. So that will be our go-to in most cases, that the desks and things will all be in those 6 foot or further apart. Some of our labs, we'll do what we can. Where we can't, we'll have additional PPE for students to use. So everything, as he said, when you come in our buildings, you see little decals on the floor about what's 6 feet apart, where we've removed furniture from places, you know, so all of our common areas, they're socially distanced. So there aren't many tables or chairs left because we're purposely not going to set anything up that would encourage students or employees to congregate in where we are exceeding social distancing. So there's 100 different answers in 100 different places, and I couldn't be more proud of our faculty, staff, chancellors, facilities folks, all trying to figure out how do we make this the safest experience we can, because that's what we're here. Our students are most important, and then for me as president, my employees, making sure that every employee is safe so that we can serve students in a safe manner is absolutely imperative.
Now, let me ask you, Dr. Elsperman, when you were in Washington there at the White House, did you have a chance to, not many opportunities, of course, because they probably want to concentrate on the discussion at the conference that you were at, but did you have a chance to maybe network with some of your fellow community college presidents and organizers to let them know how Ivy Tech was doing?
Well, I tell you what, I was the one from representing all of the community colleges in the country, but there were four-year institutions present. There were systems. There were K-12 individual system superintendents, et cetera, there. But I did get a chance to spend some time with the vice president afterwards, which was also very good because it's always important. You know, we are, as a state, to have a vice president in office, to have such a strong delegation in Congress, to be able to be invited to the table, to know that Indiana is doing many things right. We're fighting this COVID pandemic just like every other state, but I'm proud of the way our governor and all of our communities, and it's not a political thing in Indiana. We're all just trying to work to keep each other safe and ensure that our state is in a position to come back. And so we're working right now. Ivy Tech, you can just be assured we will be there. If our communities hit tremendous hot spots, we'll be watching carefully, and we don't expect to close down the state, but if a hot spot were to become where it was unsafe, we might look at a pause for a couple weeks while and go virtual, but then be able to come back. So we're going to put Hoosier safety first every time, and I think that's what I wanted to bring to the White House, and I think that's what we all need to do, have to do, whether we like wearing masks or not. I am bonding with my green Ivy Tech mask that I wear everywhere because I have to be. The only way to protect the people I care about and other Hoosiers, and so I just hope that, and I know the vast majority of Hoosiers are following those good practices, but it's just a reality. We're all going to have to do that until that cure or that vaccine or some combination is here and we can say goodbye to this terrible virus.
Dr. Sue Elsperman is the president of Ivy Tech Community College, and Louis Gonzalez is the chancellor of the Lake County campuses of Ivy Tech Community College. Thank you both for being with us on the program today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's regionally.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And that's regionally speaking for today. And for this week, I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much. And we'll be back with you on Monday.